Faherty podcast presented by Farmers Insurance. Across the sporting world, there are a chosen few TV personalities who stand out. Some stand out for their excellent command of the play-by-play position, playing point guard and dishing to their teammates to deliver at the top of their games. Others excel behind a desk, giving colour and context to the events that paint a picture outside the lines of the box score. And still others shine under the bright lights of the interview setting, disarming subjects with their own vulnerabilities and getting the most out of the conversation. But enough about me. Let's get to this evening's guest. Scott Van Pelt possesses all of those qualities and more. I sat down with him in a brewery just down the street from his home in West Hartford, Connecticut. And I got a look inside the mind and enormous heart of the man who's affectionately become known as SVP. Scott, Maryland in the late 60s and 70s set the scene for me. What were you up to?
Man, there's a lot going on. Folks got divorced, not great.
Yeah.
Challenging. I was my mom and dad's only son.
Only child.
I was six.
Yeah.
And when you're little and your folks split up, it's confusing as hell.
Yeah.
Because you think, is it my fault kind of deal? I just couldn't figure out what was going on. I can remember it being difficult at holidays because I would go and everyone was great cooks, and I can remember going places and I'd eat in the morning and then I'd go with my pop in the afternoon and we'd eat like pigs, and then I'd come home and then it was another amazing meal. And I remember one year at Christmas being like, it was dinner time and I couldn't eat, and I remember mom being bummed out, and I was like, do you realize how much food I have to eat on these? And it was like everyone did like a full stop and realized, oh, we probably shouldn't have like three full-on meals for the kid. He's having a hard time with it. But I was just figuring it out as we went along. But as I say, I always knew I was loved. I was always in the middle of love, in spite of the fact that maybe their love just sort of, you know, kind of went away. But I was a decent athlete. I loved all sports. I loved the Maryland Terrapins. I loved the Redskins. Yeah. I loved the Orioles. I remain fiercely loyal to my hometown teams.
Yeah, that's tribal.
It is.
That's what it is. You know, coming back home. And
home's always home, no matter where you go.
Yeah, exactly. I got a question here, which I'm pretty sure is a practical joke. Were you always sort of tall?
I was in, I want to say, fourth grade, and I had a good friend by the name of Tyrone Powell. Tyrone had a big afro.
Yeah.
And Tyrone, for picture day, said, I'm going to be taller than you. And so Tyrone blew his afro out as tall as he could, and on picture day, I'm there in the middle, the tallest kid, and here's Tyrone, and his face is here, and his afro is about a foot and a half tall, and we're basically the same height. But I was always the tall, really skinny kid that was trying, like a baby giraffe. I was trying to grow into my body.
Do you still have that photograph?
I've looked for it, and I can't find it. I'm convinced that someday I'm going to open up like this treasure trove, and it's going to be like this eureka moment, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like Pulp Fiction where you open up the briefcase,
yeah,
and there's this glow, and it's not gold or a treasure. It's the picture of me and Tyrone Powell next,
yeah,
to each other. I can't find it, but I know I can see it in my mind.
My mom has kept a scrapbook. There are actually several scrapbooks now. They're about so tall. And looking through them, it's disturbing in a way that we used to look like that. And
yeah, because we were same sort of era of like bad, yeah, plaid and bad, the whole
bell bottoms.
Awful.
Yeah.
Dreadful.
Platform shoes.
Sure. And then there's the teeth. You go through the time where the teeth aren't right. And maybe you've got a big one and a little one. And it's just, you look a mess.
Yeah. When did sports come into the equation?
From the very beginning.
Yeah?
From the very beginning.
Which sports?
Football. I was too skinny for football, but I loved to watch it. Basketball, for sure. I was pretty good at that. Baseball, I was as well. I was the kid playing whatever was in season, and maybe it explains how I ended up doing what I'm doing now. You know, I wasn't good enough to make my living doing them, but somehow I made my living talking about them, but they were always there.
So tell me how you ended up at the University of Maryland.
It was the only place I was ever going to go, even though for a bit of time there, I did that sort of adolescent, late teens thing where I'm going to go do my own thing.
Did you want to stay at home?
Initially, I thought I didn't, and that's why I explored some other things. My mom, my aunt, my grandfather had all gone to Syracuse. Syracuse has a remarkable communication school. I had gone up there to see it. But Maryland was always who I was. Long after I'm not the guy from ESPN, I'll always be the guy from Maryland, because that's where I'm from. It was who I was, whether I knew it or not, because my dad had gone there and we'd spent so much time going to games there. And so after kind of flirting with the idea of other places and having been accepted in some other places that would have, I'm sure, given me great opportunities, I just said, no, I'm a Maryland guy. It's who I am. Go to Maryland and just be a Terp, because that's what you are.
Was there ever any thought in your mind of a different career?
David, I don't know that I had any thought of any career, to be honest. I mean, this found me. It was miraculous. I mean, I got to give the commencement address to the Merrill College of Journalism at Maryland.
Graduates of the Philip Merrill College of Journalism, Dean Dalglish, distinguished guests, family, friends, faculty, folks who have wandered in aimlessly off of Route 1, anyone that doesn't cover, good morning.
Said, you realize you're taking advice today from someone who couldn't get into the college from which you graduated. I didn't get into the journalism school. I was a radio, TV, and film major, which is journalism light. It's for people that couldn't get into that. And I was not a focused student. I didn't, I enjoyed myself. I had a great deal of fun.
Can you explain what an FWIC is?
You've done a bit of research. the FWIC. F is what you get when you fail, W is what you get when you withdraw, I is what you get when the grade is incomplete, and a C is a C. One of the spring semesters, your man here got a FWIC. Now, you get an F, you get nothing. You get a W, you get nothing. You get an I, you get nothing. The C was in a class that I was making up for my major, which counted towards my overall GPA because I'd gotten a D before.
Right.
So the C applied to the D, which meant that now I had met that requirement, got a C in the class in my major, but it didn't account towards my semester GPA. So the F, the W, and the I all got zero. The C got zero for the semester, which made the semester GPA a 0.0.
Oh, listen, I'm not sure I've ever met anyone that has done that.
The Blutarski, 0.0. I did it. It happened. I was asked to give a speech again to journalism, and I got up on the whiteboard and I wrote FWIC. I said, did anybody know what this is? Some kid in the back's like, FWIC? I'm like, bingo, the FWIC. I said, that's what I got. I went through the whole thing, and I was like, I got a 0.0. And I look over at this professor whose face is ashen, realizing they've asked me to come speak to the future, the youth of Maryland. And here I am telling him, I got a 0.0.
So how did you get a degree? I mean, you did get a degree.
I did. I don't know how I did. I guess somewhere along the way, I did enough accumulating of B's and not a lot of B's, probably a lot of C's. And I just, whatever I was meant to do, I checked the boxes.
You just scraped through?
Barely. Scraping is still probably overstating it. I mean, I was dragging.
You know, the doctor that finishes last in medical school is still a doctor.
Every now and then I do look at the actual diploma and I think, it'll be a good metaphor for the kids someday. I mean, there's not a lot that I can tell them that I did that I'm particularly proud of, but the fact that in the end I did it, I guess at least proves that you can, even if your own worst efforts got in your way, you know, you can still accomplish the
bumble
goal.
Through.
I guess.
See, I think you're a bit like me in that, you know, you felt different. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you knew you were smart, but it didn't seem that way. And you didn't really work very hard at all, just enough to get through. That was me. That was exactly me. I didn't graduate high school.
Mm. The curse of being clever is if you know it. Right? Mm-hmm. If you think, I figured all of this out. Well, you haven't figured it all out, but you figured enough out to know kind of the shortcuts.
Yeah.
And then you end up kind of fooling yourself. I wish, looking back at it, I wish I'd have spent the time to learn, because it's fun to. And now, maybe it's why I guess I'm still so hungry now. I find myself wanting to find out things I don't know.
Yeah.
Because when I was paying to do so, I was a conscientious objector in my own education.
As a young Terp, Scott Van Pelt clearly had no problem coming out of his social shell. However, his GPA at times looked more like a tortoise on THC, you know, going nowhere quick and staying oh so close to the floor. He didn't graduate with honors, but I think he'll tell you he was just honored to graduate. But it gave him a great foundation, and let's face it, he had nowhere to go but up. Where'd you go after college, and when did this little shop of horrors called the Golf Channel, when did that happen?
There was a period of time post-Maryland, pre-Golf Channel, where I was not thriving. Yeah. I was having a very difficult time assimilating as an adult. There were a number of different jobs. I sold beepers for a period of time. And when I say I sold beavers, that's a complete lie. I don't believe I sold anything. I don't know that I
thought you said you sold beavers.
No. I'm not in the beaver trade. Right. Beaver pelts, things of that nature. None of that. Okay. Beepers, right? Hit me on the hip. Beepers. Everyone was convinced, oh, with your personality, Scott, you could sell anything to anyone.
Well, I believe that.
Right. But that presumes I would want to sell anyone anything.
Right.
And then a man who I had interned with in Washington, D.C. is part of this group that's starting the Golf Channel. And so I go down to Orlando, and they offer me a job as a production assistant. And I put what I had in a truck and drove to Orlando to see what there was to see.
You ever look at some of those tapes and cringe?
Oh, you know, sure.
Back in the
Golf Channel days?
Yeah.
Sure, is this the part where you're gonna show them?
Yeah, maybe, I don't know what they've got planned.
Don't do it.
Welcome to the Golf Channel's Leaderboard Report. From our studios in Orlando, Florida, your host, Scott Van Pelt.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show.
Oh, my God. Look at that. I remember that tie. Look at that hair. Look at the young Van Pelt. I remember the Leaderboard Report music in my head. I can hear it now. It was a 15-minute straight show. It was taped, and there were no ads, because who would sponsor a show that I was hosting?
The trusty minions and I didn't just pull some old-school footage and leave it at that. No, no. We wanted to put his royal baldness to the test and see if he could do his old highlight reels. Only we didn't give him any names on the scripts. Let's see how he fared. No mulligans.
Las Vegas Invitational, Tiger Woods, wearing genie pants and a shirt that's 11 sizes too big for birdie on 17. Bang. It's 26 under, finishes 27 under. Young Davis Love the third. Third shot, useful.
You're slipping right into it.
Well, sure. That's why I didn't do the Sam Torrance bit then, because I hadn't heard Sam Torrance say useful at calling the Open Championship. Oh, look at Freddie Couples. He still swings the same. Love Fred. He used to text me during the radio show. He was just sitting around bored out of his skull. Oh, Freddie misses the putt. That would have been for eagle. Stankowski. Did he win this one? He won at Kapalua? There's Woody Austin. He's dressed up like the American flag. And I was fat and had a terrible tie. Let me stop the tape. Look at fat me with a bad tie.
I never thought of you as fat.
David Duvall called me his royal fullness. That was after Memphis. I'd eaten a lot of ribs at the Rendezvous. All right, remember the part where I said I was proud of all this? Like I'm proud of all of it? I am not proud of this.
Okay.
All right, you've shamed me. Sufficiently shamed.
Excellent.
There's so much worse that we could find, I'm sure. I hope we don't.
You and Tiger kind of splashed onto the scene around the same time. What were your first interactions with him like?
He's the reason for my entire life.
Well, a lot of us.
True.
There might not be a Golf Channel.
I entirely agree with that. The very first event I covered as a reporter, I had been sent to Columbus to cover the NCAA championship, 1995 Scarlet course. Nota Begay and Jerry Chang and a guy named Tiger Woods played for Stanford, and that's where I met him. And then I just sort of kept turning up at places where he did stuff, like 96 was Pumpkin Ridge, he won the amateur, and then of course 97. Had a decent run there at Augusta.
Yeah, well, that was our first year at Augusta, you and me.
Correct.
Yeah.
And not a bad time to start, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
That's the 100-year flood. A lot of stuff's happened there through the years, but that's, to me, the all-timer. And his win in 97 and then the subsequent interview we did in 98, he was the tide that lifted certainly my boat, the Golf Channel's boat as well. But what's funny about the interview we did, David, is that I had gone down to Doral. I drove from Orlando down to Doral, and I went for one reason, and that was to sit in the locker room and wait for Tiger to finish, which I did. He walked in, and I said, hey, listen, Bay Hill Week, would you sit down with me? I just want to ask you some questions about the Masters. And he said, sure. So we sat down, just as the same way you and I are sitting down, and we had an elaborate setup like this for our 5 minutes. We were going to make it count. Mm-hmm. Bev Norwood, a guy, a lovely guy who had one of Tiger's people who told me, forcefully but not rudely, you got 5 minutes. Fine. I have a yellow legal pad full of everything. I'm prepared. We start going. It's obvious to me he's interested in the conversation, and he's like, you got a lot of notes there, so I'm ready to talk. He's like, let's go.
Been thinking about this for a while and looking forward to talking about it. It's hard to believe that it's been a year since Augusta, and your world has changed quite considerably since. You've got video games that you're in, you're on Wheaties boxes and what have you. Did you have any sense at all, as this was unfolding last year at Augusta, the impact that this was going to have?
No clue. I'm honestly no clue.
And so 45 minutes go, and we're still talking.
I felt so comfortable,
and
so at ease. And
Bev and his agents want to murder me. And I'm like, come get it. Like, the idea, you're going to have to drag me out of here because it was too good.
Yeah.
And we got done not too much longer after the fact. And I went back, and I walked into the office of one of the execs there, and they said, so do we have a segment? And I said, nope. We got a show.
We got a show, yeah.
That turned into this show that I suppose put me on the radar of other companies. Like, well, who's this idiot? And how do you get this from Tiger?
You've seen Tiger's ups, you've seen his downs, you've seen his return. How would you describe that to someone that just didn't know anything about it?
The fact that the story has a redemptive arc, that the comeback became as remarkable as the debut, mm-hmm. is impossible. If I told you that a man would become Superman and that he would fly at heights never before seen, and that someday that same guy would be Superman, would have to ride the bus because he couldn't fly anymore, and then he crashed the bus and it was kind of dark, but then out of the wreckage he dusts himself off and he flies again, like, would that make sense to you?
You see, that's perfect. That's what you do. You describe, you know, and that's a special gift. It really is.
Well, I appreciate that as a guy who I think is brilliant at it as well. But that to me, that's what it was. Because who he the best athletes in whatever sport, they make us feel something. And Tiger Woods made people feel.
Yeah.
And even if there were people that rooted against, which is always odd to me, I don't get it. But if you want to sit around and root for him to fail, okay, well then I guess you had a period of time where you felt good about things. Mm. But if you watched him hug Charlie and hug Sam at Augusta in 2019 and you weren't moved to tears or moved to feel, then I pity you, because you're not plugged in to life or emotion.
Have you ever seen willpower like he has, you know, the ability to impose his will over his body?
Golf, and you'd know better than I because you did it as well as you did it. All you get to do, the only thing you get to do, is to tee your ball up and shoot your score. You got nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. And yet, he totally messed with their airspace. And he, through his force of will, beat people down. And this year at Augusta felt more like one of those where he ground them down. Like, what are the odds that Molinari and Finau and Koepka are all gonna get wet on 12? What are the odds?
Unbelievable.
They've all come up short, way short.
Look, Jack had some help in 86 too, right? Mm-hmm. From Seve and from Norman, a whole lot of help. We remember what Jack did, but we not that we discount, we just don't pay, we pay more attention to Jack than we do to the others that you know, got into the wall, so to speak. But I don't know. I mean, is that, how much of that's that Molinari's standing on that tee with that guy, right? The he's the guy you're looking at, and at this place. I don't know what that's worth, but through sheer force of will, and I think this one more than any other, because I know still to this day he doesn't know how he did it.
No.
And that's the amazing thing.
While he hasn't won a green jacket, Scott has been responsible for a few amazing things in his own right in his 25-plus years in television. After departing from Golf Channel and landing in Bristol, Connecticut, he worked his way far enough up the food chain to become a mainstay on the network's flagship Sports Center broadcasts.
You ready to do this?
Let's do it.
In the years that followed, Scott would bounce around between the PGA Tour and the anchor desk, covering all four majors while spending time alongside some of the most recognizable faces in the business.
Eyes on a teleprompter.
and later thriving in the radio chair before being bestowed a show with his name on the marquee in 2015.
Welcome to Sports Center, I'm Scott Van Pelt.
But when it all began, he was just a young pup nibbling at any and every story that was put in front of him. So you moved to ESPN and they give you a segment on NASCAR.
About 2 weeks into my job at ESPN, someone had called from the ESPN news desk and they said, Scott, we are told that Dale Earnhardt might have died. And I said, well, that's awful. And I said, how can I help you? And then I realized, oh, I live nearest to Daytona. It was interesting because it was long enough ago that we weren't live and we weren't doing like breaking coverage. Thank God for that, because I wouldn't have been well versed enough to not have exposed what I didn't know.
Yeah.
But I went, and I'll never forget, there was a man, Mike Massaro, bless his heart, who was a NASCAR expert, who was also there, that helped me through it.
Yeah.
NASCAR, like golf, is a sport where if you don't know it and you talk about it.
Oh, you're done.
The minute someone says someone shoots a birdie.
Yeah.
Right?
Or pitches out of a bunker.
Or he hit a par five, whatever, you just go, ooh, you don't know what you're speaking about, and then I won't ever listen to you again.
Yeah.
Well, I would have been that guy within NASCAR, and so that was the very first moment I think I was confronted with the fact that I was no longer just doing golf. I was doing something beyond that.
A few years ago, you got to kind of carve your own show out of thin air.
I was sitting in Augusta in the house that we had stayed in for years with one of the guys who's a brilliant guy. His name's Mike McQuaid, and he's a big-time exec there and has been a great, great friend for many years. And we started having this conversation about, what if you did a show sort of like your radio show, but it was SportsCenter, and you did kind of your take on the day of sports? And I said, well, sure. They're going to let me do that. He said, no, you'd be surprised. And I kind of, come on, it's not happening. And then the conversation sort of grew, and then it got more serious, and I really loved doing radio. It was something that allowed you so much space and allowed you to connect with people on a totally different level, because the real estate was such that you had more time to fill, and it's so much more intimate. And I was really hesitant to give that up because I liked it. But then it got all the way up the food chain to the point that they said, no, we want you to do this, and we're not asking you to do it this way. We're telling you that's how you should do it. Because I was a test balloon. It's midnight, it's cable, we're not risking a great deal.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. We took elements from what we had done on radio, some commentary, and we took ideas that we kind of created in a room full of hopefully smart people and said, let's do it, let's try it this way.
You know, in a world of 140 characters, how important do you think writing is still?
Most important thing I do every day is that. I whenever anyone asks me for advice, say, oh, I want to do what you do, how do I do it? Well, you just go to a niche cable channel as it's launching, you meet a transcendent athlete as he's about to become the combination of Elvis, Pope, and an alien. befriend that guy, have him give you access, which endears you to others in the industry, and then go work there. Simple, just do that. Well, obviously you couldn't. I say write. Sit down and write, because what does writing do? It slows your mind down, because you can't write as quickly as you think.
And your mind goes 100 to the dozen, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does, and it's calming, and it's a process. It's a process of what do I think? How do I say it? Writing is the most challenging, but the most important thing I do, because it's constantly helping me to refine my voice and what it is I say and how it is I say it.
More Faherty will continue after a few words from our sponsor. We've been doing Faherty for a while now, but every episode I learn something new from our guests. Just like Farmers Insurance knows a thing or two because they've seen a thing or two. So, thanks to Farmers for supporting my show.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
All right then, now back to the show. Okay, this is rapid fire. Everyone knows the drill. Start the clock.
Yep.
What's your lowest round of golf?
70, 80.
What's your highest round of golf?
100 and who knows what.
Who's the athlete that you've met that you'd love to interview, but you haven't?
Tom Brady.
He's fierce.
Fierce is a perfect word for him. And he's also Benjamin Button because he's young. He's going to retire as a 12-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the damnedest thing.
How many Diet Cokes do you estimate that you've drunk throughout the years?
I drink lab rat portions of it. So whatever's too much, that's what I do.
Right. Who's the funniest co-host you've ever worked with?
Kenny Mayne. He's so different. And he's so authentically funny. And he sees the world through a lens that only he possesses.
The starting five of the 0-2 Maryland Terrapins. Go.
It was Steve Blake. It was Juan Dixon. It was Lonnie Baxter. It was Chris Wilcox and Byron Mouton, I think.
That is impressive. I have no idea if it's correct. If you were starting a band that played golf, what would it be called?
Kings of Swing.
All right. I was thinking the Swingleberries.
That would be better.
Excellent. Well played. You win nothing.
That's fine. I've enjoyed playing, regardless.
97 was actually both of us. It was our first Masters, and you've done every one since. Yeah. Does it get old?
Augusta?
Yeah.
No. For a million different reasons. I live in a place where it snows, and so this is a true story. I have left to go to the Masters on days where it has snowed multiple inches in Connecticut. Yeah. And you're leaving Connecticut and there's 3 or 4 inches of snow on the ground to go to Augusta. And it's all of the cliches are real. The idea of spring, the idea of renewal, the idea of friendships that are reacquainted, just the ability to stand out there by the tree and see people as they come by. My whole life is one of trying to be outwardly grateful, try to project that into the universe in the hopes that it bounces off other things and comes back to me. Mm. I stand on a spot on the par 3 course on the 8th tee that looks down over a lake every morning, and if you want to call it prayer or just a moment of calm, I go and I stand there, and I'm just thankful that I'm on the earth on this side of the dirt, and I'm standing here, and this is where I get to be today. Yeah. And if I never get to come back, well, I'm here right now, and I'll take the picture in my mind. And does that ever get old?
No. It's timeless, but it doesn't get old.
Never. And it's something that I find myself looking for. Like right now, I can think, well, I look forward to going back there. I'm not in a hurry. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to enjoy right now. But does it ever get old? It never will. Never.
What's the one Augusta story that you tell when you're sitting around with the boys?
I got to caddy for David Duval in the par 3 contest.
Am I going to get fired before it starts?
Well, the new one, they said there's 3 things that don't last long. It said dogs that chase cars, pros that putt for pars, and caddies who think they're stars.
Oh, boy.
I remember vividly moments from 97 when I remember Tiger driving down on the cart after Saturday's round where he just annihilated Colin Montgomery and was up by a million, and I looked at him and I just said, what in the hell are you doing? And he laughed and he just said, I have no idea.
Is it bad for golf to have parity, do you think, or do you need somebody, you know, out in front the way it's been?
No, I think having a pot full of stars is great. The problem that the sport is going to have for the rest of our lives is that there's only one Tiger.
Yeah.
And anything and everything is inevitably compared to him. And that's a gigantic...
Oh, it's a huge gap.
He's the only one of him there is.
Yeah.
And again, who's the person who can make you feel? Tiger made you feel, makes you feel. Can Koepka, can Justin, can Jordan, can Rory, can Tony Finau? Like, I mean, I could keep going. Mm. Fleetwood, like that. I mean, there's a zillion different flavors from all over the world, but can they make you feel? I mean, that's the hard part. Yeah. Can they make you feel like Tiger? No.
No,
they cannot. And by the way, that's not a failure of theirs.
No.
In no way is that a failure. They exist in many ways because of Tiger. He was the guy they chased. So it's not bad. It's just what's bad is when we compare to the thing for which there is no equal. That's what's bad.
Well, you've heard of the ice bucket challenge, the bottle cap challenge. We've got a challenge of our own here. It's called the SVP challenge. You've got to decide which of these guys looks the best with the new do.
Head shape's important. I have a lumpy head. I look like a beluga whale, but it's all I've got. That's good. That works well. Yeah. Oh, no.
No?
Oh, God, no. That's... Oh, Phil, that's... What's less than one? Zero.
Right.
Zero for Phil.
Okay.
Oh, Beach. Beach. I like Beach. Beach is fine. Right?
Yeah. He doesn't look that different.
No, he's sort of like a four or five. That's fine. Oh. My God. Now, he has what I dubbed the spafro. He's Spanish and he had an afro, so he's a spafro with the bun.
Yeah.
But still, you left the chops on the side. That's awful. That's a one.
It is. It's horrendous.
He looks like an actuary or something that works in, like, he's an HR guy. His name's Glenn.
Yeah.
He drives some mid-model. That's a three.
Yeah.
Maybe. Could be coming someday, young man. Lucky for him, he looks like he's got a boyish look. So it's a little tilted there. So that's five or six.
He's going to look good.
Oh, David. You look like a character in like a Guy Ritchie film that would be, he'd be like in part of a crime syndicate.
That is truly horrible. Yeah,
it is. It's awful. Yeah, because this is the best. You had a perfect head. Be happy you still have your hair.
Yeah. You are famously involved in Twitter. Why'd you get involved with that?
It's become this giant cocktail party for media folks. I think you find out a lot of information there. There are a lot of athletes there who now choose to be in control of their message, and that's where they want to share what they think. I have a colleague named Wright Thompson, who is one of the best writers there is, was on Twitter, and then he had an epiphany. And he said, why would I want to let somebody I don't even know tell me you on my phone in my pocket? And you think, I don't know. And yet that's what we've essentially given our cell phone number to anybody to send us a text to tell us we're horrible and terrible. And there's just such bitterness and anger. But you know what it is? I understand it for what it is, because when I go out into the world, when I go to an airport or a restaurant or wherever I encounter people, a game, not once in my life, zero times, have I ever had somebody say to me in person the ugliness that they say there. So I treat it as make-believe. This isn't a real thing. I use it as a source of information. I try not to allow it to be part of the addiction of the device. I fail a lot of the time. My colleague Ryan Rosillo, who I did radio with for years, would make a segment out of my Twitter disputes. And then when you'd run those back, you'd realize just how preposterous all of it was. It helped me. It's therapy. I'm trying my best. I fail a lot, though.
In 2017, you kind of went off on people bashing ESPN, and you called out the trolls. What started you off?
Things got so politically charged, and the climate became so challenging to navigate. So much of what we did became framed as, all you guys talk about is politics. And like, I never do. I talk about games. Because I don't care if you're a gigantic supporter of the president or if you're a detractor. Yeah. I assume you just want to know who won the game.
Yeah.
And I'm in the business of sports. Sports remain our greatest place to come together regardless of what we think about anything. Religion, politics, anything.
Are there kind of an antidote to religion?
Without,
and politics?
Without question. They're our greatest unifier. Always have been. And so I don't care what your politics are.
Mm-hmm.
So I push back against that because in the same way I was proud and will always be proud that I work for the Golf Channel.
Yeah.
I am proud that I work at ESPN. It's a gigantic place. Is everybody's step the correct one? Always, of course not. People fail. We fail in life every single day. All of us do. But on balance, I felt like a lot of the criticism was so drastically overstated that I wanted to just say, hold on, that's BS. And I push back.
Do you still get your news old school, you know, newspapers, magazines?
I like the feeling of a newspaper in my hands.
Yeah.
I it's weird. It's like a connection to something. Like it makes me think of my grandpa, you know, reading the Washington Post and flipping through it. And he'd get the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Voracious reader. And I am as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I sit at my computer and I do it because it's just far more convenient to do so.
Yeah.
Or I sit there and I hate the device and I hate being so...
Reliant?
I'm thinking of the word that's worse than that.
Right.
What's worse than reliant? What's worse
dependent?
Than connected? Pardon?
Dependent?
Even more than that. It's reliant, it's dependent, it's just addicted.
Addicted
is what it is.
Yeah, we're getting there.
We really are, unfortunately. And there's been fascinating articles about that, about breaking up with your phone. It was in the New York Times. And you read it, and they're like, all these things, like, you might have an issue if, all of them, it's me. My excuse is that I'm always trying to cast the widest net so that I have the most information and I know what's going on so that I can share it.
My crack research staff have tracked down some of your old colleagues, and all of them say that you basically live for sports, Diet Cokes, and working. But what do you do when you're not doing any of those three?
I'm not real good at lukewarm stuff. I mean, I'm passionate about my work, so I pour myself into it. I'm passionate about my family, so the beauty of working late at night is that I'm around during the day.
Yeah.
So oftentimes when the kids are out of school, yeah, I'm the guy picking them up, and my daughter, who is just a joy beyond my description, I picked her up from school one day, and she said, "Daddy, can we go to the playground? There's a little playground at school," and she normally goes with a little friend. And I said, "Oh, is Adelaide coming?" She said, "No, I want to play with you." And I said, "All right, cool. Let's go do that." Because you know what? She won't always want to, but she wants to.
You're not kidding.
She wants to today. And so, I don't know, man. In this last year or so, I've become, maybe it's because I got older than my dad, and maybe it's my mortality or whatever. But what I do every day is try to be just present in that space for right now. Not think about what we get to do later or what I have to do or any of the rest of it. I'm just trying to be present on the playground with my daughter right now.
You sound like a Buddhist.
I've studied that. I've read about it. I have faith, but I'm interested in what people believe, you know? I'm interested in what makes, because you know what, this is as much as I'll say about religion, I can't look at something billions of people think is true and say you're wrong.
Yeah,
I respect whatever it is you believe, and I'm curious what others believe. And what makes sense to me is to be thankful and grateful for the time that is right now, talking to you on the playground with my daughter. The fact that I freak out sometimes about what if I'm gone and they have to deal with what I have to deal with, not having their dad. And like, well, they got me right now. Mm-hmm. So I want them to know they're loved. I want them to know what that feels like, because if you know you're loved, right, you exist in soil that's really fertile, mm-hmm, to become whatever it is you. So like my kids, you know, again, I'm the old dad, but we get to do some cool stuff together.
Have you anything to prove in broadcasting? I mean, do you see yourself doing this until you're 75 or doing a Barry Sanders and walking away at the top?
I don't know if I'm at the top. I mean,
I think you're there. I mean, they're going to have to wheel me out in a bath chair with an ear trumpet.
Yeah. You
know, with a blanket over my knees.
I don't know that I'll have the energy. I don't know if I'll have the energy. Certainly not the way I do it now. Like a one-man band at 12 o'clock midnight live, however many nights a year I'm doing it, requires more energy than people might guess. Mm. And I don't want to do it if the ability to do it slips to the point that it's obvious.
Well, there's no one that's more fun in sports to listen to than you. Mm. And I really appreciate you spending the time. It's been so interesting. When eulogizing his late grandfather, Arnold Palmer, Sam Saunders said the best advice he ever received from the King was to talk less and listen more. Oftentimes in my job, the talking can get in the way of the listening. But I'm glad that wasn't the case with Scott. He's a man I've known for years, but after catching up with him, it turns out I didn't really know that much about him at all. After lending him my ear, I was glad I did, because what I learned made me respect the man even more. Thanks for joining me, Fehearty fans. That's our show for tonight. You can catch me on Facebook, Instagram, and FeherTwit. You can also find more Fehearty podcasts presented by Farmers Insurance on Fehearty.com and your favorite podcast provider. Go to Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Art19, or Google Play. Search Fehearty and subscribe. If you love the show, why wouldn't you? Be sure to leave a rating.